made the map of an island. It was elaborately and, I thought, beautifully coloured. The shape of it took my fancy beyond expression. It contained harbours that pleased me like sonnets, and with the unconsciousness of the predestined, I ticketed my performance Treasure Island. As I pored over my map of Treasure Island, the future characters of the book began to appear there visibly among the imaginary woods. Squire Trelawney, Captain Smollett, Jim Hawkins, and Long John Silver. And their brown faces and bright weapons peeped out at me from unexpected quarters as they passed to and fro, fighting and hunting treasure.
Silver, by Jonathan Smith. With Bill Patterson as Robert Louis Stevenson, John Franklin Robbins as W.E. Henley, and Maureen O'Brien as Fanny.
The Infirmary, Edinburgh, 3rd September, 1874. I have passed through deep waters since last I picked up my pen. Here's the inventory. Wednesday, 20th August, I set off from Wapping. Thursday, 21st, going north, I am somewhat seasick. Friday, 22nd of August, cold and wet. I land at Leith, train it to Edinburgh, cab it hither to the infirmary. Arrive with exactly 10 pence halfpenny in my spliken, a Scotch for purse. Am informed by Mr. Lister that probably my foot'll have to come off, and I'm put to bed in the reserved ward. Enter patient. Act One. There can no longer be any doubt that I have literally put my foot in it, and deeply, too. It will not mend. It suppurates. It is stuck in the status quo. To lose one leg was to lose one leg. But who wants to lose both, eh? At 25, I am afeard my marching days are over.
Your name, please?
William Ernest Henley.
And the date and the place of your birth, Mr. Henley.
The 23rd of August, 1849, in the city of Gloucester. Eldest son of a bookseller. Eldest of 5 sons, nurse.
The city of Gloucester?
At 2 Eastgate Street. In fact, that's right at the crossroads. And that's where I still am, you might say.
2 Eastgate Street?
On the crossroads, nurse, where life and death meet.
If you would address me as sister, Mr. Henley.
Oh, sorry, sister. But I've come up here to Edinburgh to see Mr. Lister, Mr. Joseph Lister.
Have you now?
I've read in the newspapers of his work on antisepsis, you see. And if he can't help me, I'm done for.
And your occupation, Mr. Henley?
Poet. Unpaid.
Right. If you'd go across there into the waiting room, thank you. Next. Next.
Waiting. A poem by W.E. Henley. A square, squat room, a cellar on promotion. Drab to the soul, drab to the very daylight. Plasters astray in unnatural-looking tinware. Scissors and lint and apothecary's jars. Here on a bench a skeleton would writhe from. Angry and sore, I wait to be admitted. Wait. Till my heart is led upon my stomach, while at their ease 2 dressers do their chores. One has a probe. One has a probe. It feels to me a crowbar. A poor old tramp explains his poor old ulcers. Life is, I think, a blunder and a shame.
Mr. Henley?
Yes. Yes, come in. Mr. Lister will see me now.
No, nurse will take you to your room.
When will Mr. Lister see me?
That's lower corridor, Leith 6. Thank you, nurse.
Oh. Right, here we are.
Thank you.
Do you need any help, Mr. Henley?
Help?
To undress.
No. No, thank you. Just bring me some books. A poet needs books.
Some books?
There's a hospital library, I presume.
Yes, on the upper corridor at the far end.
Good.
any books?
Just grab them, nurse. Just grab them. I'm a mucker for self-improvement. Oh.
They put me in a small, dark room. A kind of back kitchen. There's a bed. There are two chairs. A worn-out rickety table and stool. An illumination. And a sheaf of hymns hung on a plaster. It's a Calvinist cell, all right, with no books, no grog, and no company. I can see myself getting only into interminable monologues. I shall become a very Hamlet.
Nurse? Nurse!
The nurse chooses not to hear. So, a letter. To Mr. Leslie Stephen, editor of the Cornhill Magazine, London. Mr. Henley presents his compliments to the editor and begs to recommend the accompanying poems for his consideration. Mr. Henley has no resource but his pen, which has hitherto been perfectly unsuccessful. Mr. Henley is induced to make this request to a perfect stranger simply because he is entirely without friends upon whose judgment he can rely.
Nurse. Nurse!
Yes?
Nurse, may I ask your name?
All the patients in the infirmary call me nurse, Mr. Henley.
There are nurses and nurses, nurse. At the risk of getting my head lopped off, which nurse are you?
Nurse Webb.
And you're not Scottish, are you?
No, I'm not.
Well, thank God for that. Well, Nurse Webb, I have a question to ask you.
I'm sorry, I haven't had time yet to go up to the library.
No, you misunderstand. The question is, would you like to see what I'm writing? Would you?
What is it?
A poem.
Edinburgh's full of writers, I'm told. Have you ever written any poems before?
Oh, scores. And I'm sending the best 10 of them today to Mr. Leslie Stephen.
Have any of your poems ever been printed?
No. Would you like to be the first person to read this one? I'd like you to.
Enter patient.
Read it. Read it aloud to me.
What now?
Go on. I've never heard one of my poems read out.
I'm not sure I know how. I'd rather not.
It's straightforward. Read it so.
The morning mists still haunt the stony street. The northern summer air is shrill and cold. Is it sad? It feels as if it's going to be sad.
Sad?
I don't like poems that make me sad.
Sad? Why not?
Well, I think we have enough sadness all around us, don't you, without writing about it.
Oh, you do you? Well, tell that to Baudelaire. Tell that to Balzac. Go on, tell that to Dickens. Oh,
as usual, making a damn fool of myself.
Why do I do it? When I need all the company I can get. A girl, too, who in all probability turns up her pretty English nose at me, as so many others. And I could see her trying not to look down at the tremendous gash in my foot. Oh, damn. Oh, well. It may have to be another poem, my lad. I gave my heart to a woman. I gave it her branch and root. She bruised, she wrung, she tortured. She cast it underfoot. Oh, foot, man, not food. I'm not bloody Scottish. Foot, not food.
Mr. Henley.
Oh, sister.
Professor Lister will be here any minute just now on his round with his students. And this place is a disgrace.
Dear, dear.
There's paper thrown all over the floor.
There is. You are in the right.
And look at this quilt. Is this a hospital, Mr. Henley, or a rubbish pit?
Mea culpa, mea culpa.
I've never seen anything so indecent in all my born days, and that's a fact.
Blessed are the pure in fact, sister, for they alone
shall... Mr. Henley, wished. Nurse, nurse, will you straighten up this quilt now?
Clinical. A poem by... Whished. Through the corridor's echoes, louder and nearer comes a great shuffling of feet. Quick, every one of you, straighten your quilts and be decent. Here's the professor. In he comes first. Here at his elbow, white-capped, white-aproned, the sister, towel on arm and her inkstand fretful with quills, hustling the class, where the chief, his dressers and clerks at attention, bends in inspection already, out of the quiver of silence over the hiss of the spray. Look at the stress of his shoulders. Ow! Comes a low cry and the sound of breath quickly taken through teeth clenched in resolve. And the master breaks from the crowd and goes, wiping his hands with his pupils flocking and whispering behind him. Now one can see case number one sits rather pale in his bedclothes, stripped up and showing his foot swaddled in wet white lint, brilliantly hideous red.
Mr. Henley.
Oh, Professor Lister.
I've woken you, I'm sorry.
No, no, do sit down. Oh, you can't. Move over there, would you?
You've been writing.
No, oh, trying to. On and off.
May I use this piece of paper? I have an idea I want to put to you. I can best show you with a diagram.
Oh, do, please.
But, before you jump to any conclusions, I'm afraid you're not yet ready to undergo this. Not for a while.
I am.
With respect, you're not. You see, I want to expose the affected bone right down, and the idea is to make a long cut like that from ankle bone back to ankle bone, dividing vessels, tendons, everything, and make a long triangular cavity, like so, with the apex pointing to the toes. Now, this will allow me to scoop out the damage here.
Edinburgh, February the 12th, 1875. My dear wife, after lecturing in Aberdeen, I came down here and had an interesting visit to my poor contributor, W.E. Henley. He's a miserable cripple in the infirmary, who in his youth lost one foot tubercular and May Lister tells me lose the other. He has a crippled hand beside. He's been many months laid up, and in that time has taught himself French, Spanish, Italian and German. He reads such books as he can get hold of. I've taken one of his poems for the Cornhill. I'm going to see Robert Louis Stevenson this morning and intend showing him Henley's poems. Stevenson will be able to lend him books and perhaps be otherwise useful. So I hope my coming to Edinburgh will have done good to one living creature.
My waiting is over. As Madame Luck would have it, I was reading the Cornhill magazine itself. Reading, in fact, a very wrong-headed article on Hugo by someone who calls himself RLS, when Leslie Stephen strode in.
Mr. Henley. Leslie Stephen, how do you do?
How do you do? How do you do, sir? Sit down, sit down. No, no, you can't, damn.
No, no, I'm quite happy to stand for the moment, thank you.
And he stood, quite at ease, the most famous editor in England, stood at the end of my bed and spoke in the kindest, warmest manner of my poems, and how he wanted more of them, and how he wished me to write an essay for him on Balzac. I could have jumped for joy. Then, seeing the article on Hugo lying open on my bed, he sought my opinion of it. From something furtive in his eyes, however, I sensed he was playing with me. I asked him who this RLS was.
Have you not heard of him? He's a regular contributor to the Cornhill.
It wouldn't be you, would it? The real Leslie Stephen?
Oh, no, no, no. He lives here in Edinburgh. You must meet him. He's much your age. He has a fine, lucid style, don't you think?
Oh, his style is fine enough and lucid enough.
And his ideas on Hugo?
Oh, his ideas on Hugo are complete balderdash. Doubt he's even read the books.
This plain speaking amused Stephen even more, and after shaking my hand in the friendliest way and wishing me good luck, he left. I will need his good luck today. Today I am to be borne to the theatre in a basket, like poultry. I look down at my five little piggies who go to the market with me. Wee, 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 may they all return home.
There comes the basket. I am tremulous and a trifle sick. Here comes the basket to carry me through the sweet mystery of chloroform into the drunken dark.
Are you ready, Mr. Henley? The porters are here.
Thank you. I am ready. But, gentlemen, my porters, life is brittle. You carry Caesar and his fortunes. Steady!
Close your eyes, Mr. Henley.
Then she bids you close your eyelids, and they mask you with a napkin, and the anesthetic reaches hot and subtle through your being.
No, I'm not RLS, but you must meet him.
And you gasp and rack and shudder in a rushing, swaying rapture, while the voices at your elbow fade, receding, fainting. Further.
Well, what do you think? Lewis, one moment. It's good, isn't it?
Mm.
Has some talent, don't you agree?
A man's lived, Leslie, and that's the point. He's looked right over the edge. And at a leap, I store him the thick, sweet mystery of chloroform, the drunken dark, the little life and death. The gods are good to me. I have no wife. Oh, that's damned fine. The man makes me feel pampered.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And he's poor.
Poor as well?
Poor as a church mouse.
Poverty and self-education are shaming things. But he has a big beard, I hope, like a buccaneer.
Oh, my word. He has presence, all right. And flaming eyes and fizz and crackle.
Fizz and crackle?
With a few oaths to spare.
I can't wait.
Mind you, Lewis, he's not everyone's cup of tea.
Who wants everyone's cup of tea?
Even so, prepare yourself.
For what?
You'll see.
Sister, now fill this cavity right down to the bone with strips of lint.
Uh-huh.
Like that?
Yes.
2-inch strips.
2-inch strips.
Steeped in carbolic acid and changed every 4 hours.
Then the lights grow fast and furious, and you hear a noise of waters, and you wrestle blind and dizzy in an agony of effort.
And don't at any stage let him move. And pull the foot right out.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. To expose every part of the cavity, but keep it firmly clamped.
Joseph Lister is an Englishman, with no more guile in him than a set of sheep's trotters. And whether he save my remaining trotter or no, we may rejoice therefore. The conceit of these bloody Scotchmen is something atrocious.
And keep a close eye on him.
I will, Professor.
Oh, she will, Professor, as sure as God's in Gloucester.
Upper corridor, Leith 6. Leith 6, upper corridor.
Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how strait the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul.
Mr. Henley, may I come in?
You may. You may. And don't tell me who you are, lad. I know. Robert Louis Stevenson.
And I've brought you some friends.
Some Balzacs.
Leslie said that you liked Balzac. I'm sure he said...
Like Balzac. Like... Anything so impudently, so exuberantly French, I love. Thank you. Thank you. But, hey, draw a chair up to the fire. You look cold.
I've just heard Beethoven's third, the greatest soul the world has yet produced. That's warmth enough, eh?
Beethoven the greatest, you think so?
Oh, certainly. That is until we came along.
I couldn't agree with you more.
How did it go? Then she bids you close your eyelids, and they mask you with a napkin, and the anesthetic reaches hot and subtle through your being. When I read those lines of yours, Henley, I was not only moved to the soles of my shoes, I was also hearing a new voice.
Thank you. And I've read your work, your essays, your stories, every word I've read.
Even my article in Victor Hugo?
Ah, yes. Well, give the fire a good rattling, will you?
It's a leaden sky, all right. The old city has its visor down again.
Put more coal on, if you would.
So what's wrong with my view of Hugo?
It's your view of melodrama that's wrong.
Melodrama?
You're right in saying Hugo's more melodramatic than Fielding or Richardson. But that is not at all the same thing as saying he's melodramatic in the bad sense.
Well, what about his medieval history? That's claptrap. That's pushery, sure.
No, you mistake melodrama for the color of life, for the smell of blood.
Do I?
Yes. You need blood and boldness in books. Hugo's life may look melodramatic from your study, Stevenson, but it doesn't from the street gutter. Nor from the poor victim's perspective.
I don't think, with respect, you quite grasp...
Even Dickens doesn't look melodramatic from a back room in the Edinburgh Infirmary.
Well, all right, let us take Dickens. You've read his Christmas books?
I have, and I've heard him read from them. One night in Bristol. And I can tell you he's a greater soul than Beethoven. Greater than Beethoven!
You would recommend his Christmas books?
I would. Would not you?
You don't think that they're too much?
Oh, I recommend them because they're too much. I can't have enough of too much, can you? Take Macbeth. Isn't that too much?
And when he laughed, I knew we were friends. I looked at him, and he laughed, and he stopped, and laughed again. He looked slyly at me, as if to see if I were real. And I looked straight at him. He's a slip of a thing, really. More of a lass than a lad. Yeah, that's not right. When the nurse came in, he was up on his feet and winning her with his ways. How best to describe him? He's valiant in velvet. Thin-legged, long-fingered, slight unspeakably, thin-chested, wild. There's a look-at-me straw hat in his long hand and something of the cripple in his cough. Are we cripples, perhaps, who need each other?
Strange you should mention Macbeth. It was the first play my mother ever read me. She read it to me and my nurse one windy night.
You had a nurse?
Aye. And I realize now mother omitted a fair wee bit.
In consideration of nurse?
And of my immortal soul. This is Edinburgh, Henley, a citadel of the proprieties.
What? Omitted what? Such as?
Need you ask?
The porter's lines.
Because what three things, Henley, does drink especially provoke?
Nose paintings.
Sleep.
And urine.
And lechery.
It provokes.
And unprovokes.
It provokes the desire, Stevenson.
But takes away the performance, Henley.
It makes you stand too, Stevenson.
And not stand too, Henley.
Everything all right, Mr. Henley?
Yes. Fine. Thank you, sister. Mr. Stevenson and I were discussing books, and I never felt better.
Oh! 17 Heriot Row, Edinburgh,
13th of February, 1875. Dear Catherine, dearest cousin, yesterday Leslie Stephen encouraged me to visit a poor fellow, a sort of poet who writes for him, and it was very sad to see him there in a little dark room. The gas flared and crackled, the fire burned in a dull, economical way, and the poor fellow sat up in his bed with his hair and beard all tangled and talked as cheerfully as if he had been in a king's palace of the blue air.
And today he was an aerial. An aerial walked in. An aerial, quick through all his veins with sex and temperament and style, all eloquence and balls and brains, heroic, also infantile, without the faintest touch of guile, yet living but to plot and plan. Behold him, bubbling into bile.
Rum! Rum for my buccaneer!
Rum! Oh, the dark, sweet mystery. Now, you first, Lewis.
Damn it all, I brought it all for you.
Ah, I believe you. Watch the door. Keep an eye on sister.
I'd rather not.
Oh, rum. Rum.
It's good.
I wasn't expecting you again so soon, lad. What is it? What's wrong?
Oh, I'm sick of this place.
So am I.
No, I mean Edinburgh. And I'm sick of myself. I'm half suffocated with family.
Family?
Aye.
Ah, I know your type. You're too coddled, Lewis, that's all.
Coddled?
Yes, with your nurse at home and your over-education and your mother's wee worries.
My mother?
And your father's high hopes. They're real aristos, I bet, all your relatives.
No, they're not.
I bet they are.
It's not that at all. It's the daily lack of comprehension, Henley. It's the daily small injustices coupled with mouthing moralities until I despair even of a hearing. Until I think the rigidity will ride me like a nightmare. Until I hate the sight of the man I love. It's my father, after all. My father.
So, come to London with me, lad.
I will, but when will you be in your feet?
Foot, man. Foot.
Why, sorry.
Have you been writing? Have you?
I have that.
And?
And it's the usual. It's second rate. It's third rate. It's a PB, but however I try to improve it, it remains veritable vomit.
A PB?
A pot boiler.
Well, sit down. Sit down. You're as restless as a spaniel. Sit and listen to this.
Not another poem by W.E. Henley.
Yes, en route to London and Mr. Leslie Stephen.
He told me he's going to give you a little push. Did you know that?
Really?
Really?
Listen, lad, I don't need a little push from anyone. I'm a bohemian. I write fast. I blast. And this one is hot.
It smokes.
Tis about life and death.
Now there's a theme for you, life and death.
About Madam Life and the ruffian on the stair. Sit.
Great. Ready.
Madam Life's a piece in bloom. Death goes dugging everywhere. She's the tenant of the room. He's the ruffian on the stair.
He's the ruffian on the stair.
Is it veritable vomit?
Not so far. No.
Dear Catherine, my poet, my Henley, writes good stuff. It is slack still and unequal, but he makes good songs, and here and there has a good idea. Most days I am more in the infirmary than at home, and not as a patient, you understand, but visiting my roaring one-legged buccaneer, for whom I have a plan of escape.
I am up and about a bit in my room, but a hell of a lamester. This morning I saw my foot, and I can assure you, journal mine, that the aspect of it is not calculated to put me in spirits, or to give me any higher opinion of my wretched self than the tolerably cynical one I already have. There's a huge ulcer on the stump end, as big as a sovereign. And I have a swelled testicle. Does death have his eye on me yet?
With my bohemian, I find I am changed myself. all my sham goodness. I mean, the orderliness, the citizenliness, and the sort of respectability that I had laid on is going away and down through wind into everlasting space. I cannot say how glad I am of it, how glad I am to feel my own body again and recognize my own laugh.
Dear Lewis, it has occurred to me lately that you might help me in an ever-recurring difficulty. I am constantly looking out, rather vaguely, for a new novelist. I should like to find a Walter Scott or Dickens or even a Miss Bronte or George Eliot. I cannot help thinking that if you would seriously put your hand to such a piece of work, you would be able to make a mark. Of course you must have thought of this, but a little push from outside may help the thought to develop itself. I have a strong persuasion that if a good subject struck your fancy, you could make a good piece of work. When you next see Henley, please tell him that the last contribution he sent in was...
Lewis did not visit yesterday. On days he does not visit, the pain is much worse. The ulcer on my stump won't heal. The professor can, I think, do no more for me. Added to that, my guts won't work. At the moment, if it isn't one thing, it's another, and usually both. Testicles still swollen to twice its size.
Success!
What?
Success! Get dressed! I'm taking you out.
Out? Are you mad? Out where?
Outside for a day, it's agreed. We'll go cruising. Madam Life invites you to clutch a petticoat, and I am carrying it.
I'm a fair hold of a listing ship, lad. And you're but a bag of bones.
All things considered, Henley, and with a face like a ham, you'd do better not to judge an appearance, eh?
A ham? Give me that mirror there.
No, sorry, I didn't mean that. The point is, I've seen Professor Lister, and Professor Lister approves.
A boiled ham or a smoked ham?
Neither. Now, bring your poems and we'll drive and declaim as we roll along.
I haven't any poems.
Why not? Leslie wants more. He's written to say some...
I've run dry. That's why not.
Careful! Careful! Fire the port! Avoid the bell rock!
No! Starboard! Starboard! By God, Lewis, your seamanship is Jimmy! Hey, you don't know your port from your whiskey!
He's slipping off! Mr. Henley, hold on!
Lend a hand then, sister!
Dear, dear. There.
Oh, that's better. Dry land, D'Artagnan. Thank you, sister. You've steadied the ship.
The state you two are in, you'd both be better in your beds. Have you seen a doctor lately, Mr. Stevenson?
I have indeed, yes, in a way, and...
I don't like the look of you.
Entirely mutual.
Forward! I'll see you later, sister. Thank you. The world invites us!
Oh, I tell you, Henley, I'm a marked man for the official eye.
Never fear! Act two! Exit patient!
While he was in the carriage, it was splendid. It is just now the top of spring with us. The whole country is mad with green. To see the cherry blossom bitten out upon the black firs and the black firs bitten out of the blue sky was a sight to set before a king.
What noise is that?
The water.
The water. Oh, oh, the water.
I have lost the sense of wonder, of course. But there must be something to wonder at, for Henley has eyes and ears and an immortal soul of his own. The whole man rings true like a gold sovereign. And brave.
Brave. Lewis, look!
Aye, the gleam of a stocking.
The gleam of a stocking. Aye. Four Straighten Place, Portobello, Edinburgh. Listen, just listen to that address. Real aristo, eh? Yes, I am out of hospital, uncured, maimed but serviceable, with hopes of life. The muses also smile on me now and then, but they pale. More news, newsy news. I joined the Encyclopedia Britannica 3 weeks ago. I wrote a stunning article, and they sacked me for incompetence. Such is life. Still, in July, will appear in the Cornhill magazine Hospital Outlines, Sketches and Portraits by a friend of ours, which his name, I will not deceive you, is Henley. Invest a shilling. My back aches, my foot grinds, so I've rigged up a couch in the drawing room and I'm working very secretly.
on the idea of a play. A play with which Lewis and I together will dazzle the world. When in he flies and is not to be denied.
Will Pack. Pack? When I've just moved myself into good society? Never.
Pack, I said.
Ah, the mother and the father, is it?
He tells me I've rendered his whole life a failure. But now, what a thing to see.
Take no notice. Have a drink.
Take no notice. What about when she says you're killing your father as surely as God's in his heaven?
No, she's wrong. As surely as God's in Gloucester. That's where God is. Gloucester.
Is that so?
Aye, that's so. Lewis, come on, calm down. Who needs family when we are friends, eh? Who needs women when we have dreams?
I need my family, and that's a fact.
You need them from a distance, lad.
You're right.
Of course I'm right.
So before murder is done, or seen to be done, in 17 Harriet Row, before hell's doors close on me, swift as a wind, let's slip through and shoot for heaven. Pack.
There is what you might call a wee problem with packing.
You haven't any cases?
I haven't any lucre.
Problem solved. Some jingle jingle.
Oh, you're sure?
I am sure. I give you London.
London, Lewis. I'll show you Fleet Street. And the Strand.
Fleet Street.
Fleet Street.
And you must meet my cousin Catherine. She writes too. And still better by Porthos to Paris. Just think of the scene, of all the stories travel will bring us. We must move.
No. London first. To London. And to your cousin Catherine.
Who cares? Just pack your bags.
Give me a moment, man. Give me a moment.
Of where and how I nothing know, and why I do not care. Enough, if even so, my travelling eyes, my travelling mind can go. By flood and field and hill, by wood and meadow fair, beside the Susquehanna and along the Delaware.
Beside the what, did you say? And along the where?
Beside the Susquehanna and along the Delaware.
Where's that?
The rivers in America.
America? No, Lewis. Not the land of dollars and spew. We, that is you and I, are not going to America. Never.
Ach, what on earth do you know of America?
Enough. Enough.
You don't. You don't even know two of its main rivers.
Since when did one man of letters judge another man of letters on his geographical grasp, eh? Americans have fat pockets and long arms, and that is all you need to know. Lewis, I'm serious.
Out of my country and myself I go. Take a south, driver, south and over the seas where the nights are as warm as milk.
Lewis! Lewis! Wait for me, damn you.
I barely had time to sit down and look back at the old grey city and the stony streets. I scarce had a moment to think of the hospital, half workhouse, half jail, where 15 months I had been, and where every day life and death meet, because Lewis was riotous.
The wild crimson pines, eh?
Flash across the level, we thunder under bridges, we bicker down the cuttings, we sway along the ridges.
I give you William Elder Henley, poet
and playwright.
Playwright?
Are you deaf?
That's the hardest path to climb, Will. You realize that, don't you?
Wait until you've heard the idea I have for us, and when you've heard it, if it don't grab you by the ghoulies, call me sot.
Grab me, go on.
Sober, law-abiding citizen by day, but at night, he climbs out of his bedroom window and meets whores and riffraff in low stews, a man with dark reaches in his soul.
Deacon Brody!
With Mr. Henry Irving as deacon. And here, for your perusal, is the plot of our play. We charge the tunnels headlong, the blackness roars and shatters, we crash between embankments, the open spins and scatters.
I love you, Henley, from my soul. You're a genius, and I'm a genius.
A genius?
When I see a man, Henley, who does not think pretty well of himself, I always suspect him of being in the right. Success, 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 success.
Four Earls Terrace, Devonport Road, Shepherd's Bush. That's where I live. That is where I lodge, where I scribble.
At 281 The Strand, a dingy skylight, I sit at the assistant editor's desk, buried in copy. Day and night I work with my blue pencil, like a wounded Achilles. Lewis. Lewis, knowing I have books on everything, asks for a large work on pirates. Pirates. But I thought we agreed on Brody. There are no pirates in Deacon Brody's life.
Well...
Yes?
It's not coming naturally. I can't force the pen. It has to flow.
Work at it. Then it'll flow. Damn it. What do you imagine we all do?
I've tried, Will. Plays of madness for me just now. You must see that. I've been speaking to Leslie about it.
Madness?
Aye.
And I also see you have your tourist's raiment on.
I have to move.
But you haven't even introduced me to your cousin Catherine.
I have to move for my health and my work.
But we've only just arrived.
I have to move. I travel but to go. I travel for travel's sake. And to write about it afterwards.
Well, move. Move!
And, dear God, you went, as lightly as Ariel, and he left me here in this hole. Left me for France and Spain. Why France, Lewis? Why Spain? Why so far? I busy myself in work, I try to write poems. Try as I might, I am rejected by every editor of standing in London, well nigh in the world. I face the fact, I am beaten in art, and will addict myself to journalism. I am an editor. Do I not arrange? Do I not edit? And am I not master? My blue pencil flashes. Clarify and strain, I tell my writers. Clarify and strain. But 'tis not romantic. 'Tis not bohemian. And it promises to master me. The spring is spring no more. And I am out of key.
On the move, France. My dear Goss, this place has a garden like a fairy story and a view like a classical landscape. I have, by the way, sent travels with a donkey to Henley because he acts for me now in all matters. He has it, like all my other books. He is my unpaid agent and one that has rather more than doubled my income on the spot.
Robert Louis Stevenson. Travels with a donkey in the Cévennes, wherever they bloody are, 1879.
Grez-sur-Loing, that is 60 miles southeast of Paris, because although your French is first rate, my dear lad, your geographical grasp is a bit jimmy. I never thanked you formally for the 100 quid you sent, and the Lord knows I never thanked you for the introduction to Chatto and Windus, but gratitude is a tedious sentiment. And yet I think you should be very sure of one thing, that I am a man not liable to take offence, not to change in my affections. I am hard and selfish and forgetful and too easily filled with my own affairs, but my heart, such as it is very faithful to those it loves. And yet, even while I was exulting in my solitude, I became aware of a strange lack. I wished a companion to lie near me in the starlight, silent and not moving, but ever within reach.
Louis.
I saw her through the window of a hotel.
And I saw you.
In Grez-sur-Loing.
In Grez-sur-Loing. At Chevillon's Inn.
Act 3. Enter Fanny Vandergrift Osborne. Mother of two, 9 years older than Lewis. American.
He's a tall, gaunt Scotchman with a face like Raphael, and between over-education and dissipation has ruined his health and is dying of consumption. He is the heir to an immense fortune which he will never live to inherit.
What?
To live out of doors, far from the city, with a woman a man loves, is of all lives the most complete and free.
I can't read this!
A man is tormented by a very imperious physical desire. It spoils his rest. It is not to be denied. The doctors will tell you, not I, how it is a physical need, like the want of food or slumber.
But I do wish you wouldn't burst into tears in such an unexpected way. It is so embarrassing. One doesn't know what to do, whether to offer him a pocket handkerchief or to look out of the window.
The doctors tell me you're ill, Lewis.
The most beautiful adventures are not those we go to seek. I hate now to go to bed when there is no dear head upon the pillow, and I can't help that either, God help us.
God help us, this is veritable vomit.
Times are changed with him who marries. There are no more bypath meadows where you may innocently linger, but the road lies long and straight and dusty to the grave. Marriage is a step so grave and decisive that it attracts light-headed, variable men by its very awfulness. They think it will sober and change them.
Louis, you said you were coming for a walk across the field.
I know.
Half an hour ago. More than.
Just finishing a letter.
Where's Lloyd?
Guess. We're a team of artists, Lloyd and I. You wait till you see his colours.
I've never seen him so happy. Who are you writing to?
To Henley.
Didn't you write to him yesterday?
He's a brick. You must meet him. I've known him for years.
It's pages.
We're old friends. Aren't we, lad? Oh, her eyes. Her eyes are of gold and brambled hue. Gold and brambled hue.
Her eyes, I am reliably informed, are of a man sighting a pistol.
Dear boy, I have been struck by the love which may befall any of us at the shortest notice and overthrow the most settled habits and opinions.
And I have been struck by news of a little watchdog at your side, a determined little brown face with white teeth and grizzling hair.
Lloyd? Lloyd, have you seen Mr. Stevenson this morning? Mr. Stevenson, have you seen him?
He went up the hill.
Without his coat? Which path?
I don't know.
You and your maps. What is this one?
It's Treasure Island. Mr. Stevenson and I are doing it.
Oh, do show me.
That's Spyglass Hill.
Yes.
And there are strong tides off the coast there.
Uh-huh.
That's Skeleton Island.
Mm-hmm.
And that's North Inlet. And you have to guess where the treasure's hidden.
Go on. Hurry after him with this.
Yes, Mother.
And ask him when he will be back.
There is to be a private divorce in January, and yours truly will himself be a married man as soon hereafter as the law and decency permit. The only question is whether I shall be alive for the ceremony.
London is dead, Lewis. The magazine expired on Saturday last, on the 114th week of its age, deeply regretted by none who knew it, excepting myself, its author, founder, and slave. Exit W.E.H., editor. Too often, my lad, my energies seem with last year's snows, and I am all dry rot. Then I think of our play, Deacon Brodie, and my spirits lift. Even the phrase, our play, lifts me. And I have one or two other ideas for you. Have I ever mentioned Admiral Guinea to you? Have I?
Last year, I pocketed £268. For a married man who is sick and has a sick wife and a boy at school, it's a scrimp. But I'll make this boys' book business pay. There's lucre in it, laddie.
Lewis!
I'm told that there are people who do not care for maps, and I find it hard to believe. Here is an inexhaustible fund of interest for any man with eyes to see or tuppence worth of imagination to understand with. I had some paper before me and was soon writing out a list of chapters. How often have I done so before and the thing gone no further, but there seemed an element of success about this enterprise. Treasure Island was to be a story for boys. No need of psychology or fine writing. And I had a boy at hand, a boy I almost feel my own to be the touchstone. Women and Lloyd's orders were to be excluded. And at the end of each chapter, he reads to me.
How that personage haunted my dreams. On stormy nights when the wind shook the four corners of the house, I would see him in a thousand forms and with a thousand diabolical expressions. Now the leg would be cut off at the knee, now at the hip. Now he was a monstrous creature who had never had but one leg, and that in the middle of his body. To see him leap and run and pursue me over hedges and ditches was the worst of my nightmares.
Louis, supper.
Fanny, come and sit with us. Come here, sit and listen. Listen to Lloyd.
Do, Mother.
You approve of the story so far, darling, do you? Here, put this rug around you.
Listen, good. Go on, Lloyd. The next section. As I was waiting,
a man came out of the side room. At a glance, I was sure he must be Long John. His left leg was cut off close by the hip, and under the left shoulder he carried a crutch, hopping on it like a bird. He was very tall and strong, with a face as big as a ham, plain and pale, but intelligent and smiling.
Is there any blood? Show me your handkerchief.
Just a touch. Just give me a minute or two. I've had it before.
Tomorrow morning you're visiting the doctor.
There's no need.
I have already contacted him. There's every need. For the last 2 weeks I've been...
Do you like Long John, Lloyd? Do you like the old sea dog?
Yes, he frightens me, though.
Don't you think he's bad? Isn't he the villain?
I don't know, Mother. I just like him.
You wait till Jim is in the apple barrel.
Why? What happens?
If this don't fetch the kids, Henley, why then they have all gone rotten since my day. Will you be surprised to hear that it is about buccaneers, that it begins in a public house on the Devon coast, that it is all about a mutiny and a sea cook and a song with a chorus. Yo-ho-ho in a bottle of rum.
Yo-ho-ho in a bottle of rum.
And at the second ho, you heave at the capstan bars. It was a real buccaneer song. I trust this finds you well, Will. It leaves me so-so. Appetite, dicky. I must stick to my bed, which is rotten and tedious, but can't be helped. It was not consumption this time, though consumption it has to be sometime, as my kind friend the French doctor sings to me.
Louis? Louis, you've turned me into a fiction, haven't you? You've turned against me, turned me into a character. That woman has changed you.
But you always were larger than life and bolder than the bold. Can you feel... Surely you can feel the affection in it, eh? And you're wrong about Fanny. Quite wrong. My wife is far from well. Far from well. Oh, Will. On chapter 15 of Treasure Island, my mouth went empty. I'm not sure, though, my incapacity to work is wholly due to illness. The morphine I've been taking for my bray may have had a hand in it. It moderates the bray, but I think sews up the donkey. If only I could get in trim and get the work done.
Leave it now. You must get some sleep. Louis, please. It's all gone wrong, hasn't it? Treasure Island.
No, it's me. I feel commonplace. I need to move.
Wait till the spring.
The spring?
You mustn't travel in this weather.
If I'm not wound up, I'll soon run down. I need someone to wind up a clock. And there's Cousin Catherine to see in London. And a few other things. I promised Henley we'd all meet.
We'll talk about it in the morning.
If I see Henley, I'll pick up. And my work will pick up. The old rogue makes me feel chipper.
Madam, life's a peace in bloom.
Death goes dogging everywhere.
She's the tenant of the room.
He's the ruffian on the stair.
In those days, I had something to say, eh, Louis?
You still have, lad.
Haven't you drunk enough, Louis?
But in those days, I was as bold as Balzac. Hey, wasn't I?
Oh, now, don't go comparing yourself with Balzac, old
man. Damn it! I'll compare myself with whomsoever I like. Haven't I read everything?
Henley.
Oh, what? Yes?
Is it you, my bold blade, I hear saying a sordid and rank twaddle in my ear?
Twaddle?
Blundering, man, blundering.
Am I? Oh... Mrs. Stevenson. I am sorry. I have an infinite capacity for blundering, famous for it.
But tomorrow we will seize Deacon Brodie by the throat.
Tomorrow? You mean start? Together?
I do.
Tomorrow we are to see your cousin, Catherine.
We will tomorrow, Lewis. Good lad, good lad.
After lunch, after we've seen Catherine, my dear.
Hard a la board, Lewis.
No. Port. I said port.
You did. That's a fact.
And I carried you past a female dragon and down the infirmary stairs.
You carried, Mr. Henley?
Well, half carried. And that was the day I first hit on Deacon Brodie.
I'm sorry. Excuse me, but who is Deacon Brodie?
It's our play.
I don't understand. But who is he?
A model of propriety, an Edinburgh man, hanged for burglary.
But haven't you already more than you can do? There's Treasure Island still, and you said when you arrived in England...
I could surely manage both, my dear.
Treasure Island is the best thing Louis has ever written, Mr. Henley, in the highest degree exciting.
Not now, Fanny.
And what are you working on, Mr. Henley?
Me? Oh, I contribute, you know, here and there.
Contribute?
Yes, scraps and shreds of shot rubbish. Or, as Lewis would say, veritable vomit.
I can't imagine any such phrase in Lewis' mouth.
Can't you? More drink, Lewis?
No, I cannot.
Ah, well, then you don't yet know him. However, I won't dispute with you as to the propriety of certain epithets. Let us drop the veritable and just call my recent work vomit.
Mrs. Fanny Van der Grift Osborne Stevenson. A meddlesome minx with no imagination. And she's beginning to call herself a writer. She's got you, Lewis, and her boy. What more does she want? You want to write that play with me? I can see you do, but will the guard dog let you out, eh? Still, you left me one reliable friend. Here's to you, Lewis. Will I die of drink? Why not? Won't I pause and think? What? Why, in seeming wise, waste your breath? Everyone dies, and of death.
And I own I was half frightened when I saw Silver drawing near. He did not know that I had overheard his counsel from the apple barrel. And yet I had, by this time, taken such a horror of his cruelty, duplicity, and power, that I could scarce conceal a shudder when he laid his hand upon my arm.
Go on, Lloyd.
Where's Louis?
How would I know? Go on.
Ah, said Long John, this here is a sweet spot for a lad. Why, it makes me young again. I was gonna forget my timber leg, I was. It's a pleasant thing to be young, and to have 10 toes, and you may lay to that. And clapping me in the friendliest way, he... Mother, may I go to the theater with Mr. Henley and Louis?
I shall need to know the play. When?
Tomorrow night. Mr. Henry Irving's in it.
That's the first time. Lloyd...
Yes, Mother?
No, doesn't matter. You go to bed now. Just leave the pages in the order they are on the desk. Good night.
Mother, may I?
Off to bed, Lloyd. But Silver gave him no time to recover. As agile as a monkey, even without leg or crutch, Silver was on top of him next moment and had twice buried his knife up to the hilt in that defenseless body. The whole world swam away from me in a swirling mist. Silver and the birds and the tall spyglass hilltop going round and round and topsy-turvy before my eyes and all manner of bells ringing.
No, no, that's not fair, Fanny.
I'm afraid it is, my dear.
You know how it is with old friends you haven't seen for so long.
He may mislead you, that fiend. He is not misleading Lloyd.
Fiend?
A fiend, dressed as a friend.
Rot. There isn't a sentence I've written in which Henley hasn't given support or reproof or comment.
Reproof, I can imagine. The way he shouted at me.
That's the drink.
He's always borrowing money from us, and when he isn't...
We've always borrowed money from each other right from the start.
He's foul-mouthed. He stinks of whiskey. Our whiskey. And he wears you out. Take this ridiculous play.
That's no great problem. We've completed a first
yes,
draft.
Yes, but then there's another for you to start. Admiral, somebody or other. He's clearly wearing you out. He's giving you germs. You're not sleeping, and if this goes on, he'll murder
I've
you.
I've never slept well.
All the more reason not to go on in this way. And I've decided you need a warmer climate. I've decided.
Oh, well, I won't sleep at all after this, will I? How can I with all this flimsy flightiness?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I was only trying to take care of my dearest boy.
Don't sacrifice yourself for me.
I don't. I can't sacrifice myself for you, Louis. The very fact that I can do everything for you makes it a pleasure. It's not a sacrifice.
Good.
Though if I did it for another living person, it would be a sacrifice. Your writing is too important to be thrown away in these collaborations. I'll never, never see Mr. Henley again.
Well, my dear, you will. On Friday.
I will not.
He's asked us and Catherine over to Shepherd's Bush. Oh, look, at least you like Catherine. It'll be a different sort of evening. She's going to read us one of her short stories. You love short stories.
The spring, my dear, is no longer spring. Does the blackbird sing what he sang last year? Are the skies the old immemorial blue? Or am I, or are you, grown cold?
And the girl, wrapped in introspection, sits alone in the corner seat of the carriage, travelling on. She stares at her feet, but sees only his absent face. Both she and the expressionless aspect on her pale brow and the movement of the dark, smoky train seem mechanical.
Mm. Ah. Yes. Hand on heart. It grabs. Doesn't it, my lad?
That's a fine shape, Catherine. It's a delectable little job.
Do you really think so?
I do.
Well, you're a famous writer, you see, and I feel such a fool being here while you all sit and listen. I know I haven't fully worked out the last part, but I thought I'd give you the gist of it.
It'll come when ripe. It'll come.
I'm not sure, to be honest, how much the reader should know about her past.
It frightens them more because we're not sure.
Exactly.
She's from a lunatic asylum, isn't that the case?
Perhaps.
The whole idea, as Lewis has just explained, is that we're not sure.
It seems fairly evident that she is a lunatic.
But the opening, Catherine. The first scene. Now, that does need a little. Yes, there, you do need to clarify and strain.
He says this to everyone. Clarify and strain. How often over the years he's told me that.
Yes, clarify and strain. Them's the words, my girl. You see, don't grab them quite enough at the start. Grab them by the ghoulies, girl, and hang on hard.
I don't agree.
You don't?
No. I was very taken by the opening.
You were?
Yes, I was. The opening is quite perfect. If I may, I'd like to borrow the story for a day and listen to Lloyd read it tomorrow. Because I think the problem is quite another.
Oh, the critics on the hearth, eh?
Do tell me, please. I know you write too, Fanny, and I do so want to better it.
It's the girl left on the train. That is the weakness.
What about her?
She should not, in my opinion, be from a lunatic asylum. That smacks too much of realism.
Nobody is sure she is from a lunatic asylum.
All of us here think so, and I don't think that is sufficiently strong.
That's up to Catherine. It is her story.
A moment ago, you were telling her to improve the opening.
There's a difference, perceptible to most, between improving the opening of a short story and changing the basic idea.
Well, fine.
In simple English, improvements are changes, are they not?
If there is one thing I do not require, it is Americans talking to me about simple English.
What changes or improvements would you make, Fanny?
I'm not sure at the moment.
Yes, you are, my dear. Tell us.
If Mr. Henley permits another opinion but his own. All right, then. As I was listening, Catherine, and I was very much taken with the story, I was thinking to myself, how much better if the girl were not from an asylum, but a spirit. Say, a water spirit.
You think so?
A spirit or a Nixie. A malignant little charmer.
A Nixie?
Yes.
I'm not sure I've heard of a Nixie. Have you, Will?
Some Teutonic troll or other, isn't it?
Short stories with a supernatural sense are often very successful. For instance, if you take Edgar Allan Poe...
Do you remember that afternoon, that Sunday afternoon, when, as the Kirks were ringing on, and the grey city teemed with Sabbath feelings and aspects, Lewis, our L-E-W-I-S, then, now the whole world's, came laden with Balzac's big yellow books, quite impudently French, the first of many visits to that transformed back kitchen where I lay so long, so many centuries, or years, is it, ago? Nurse Webb, of the inviting eye, sister, and Professor Lister. Do you remember, Lewis? In those days, you needed me.
Yes, well, I believe you may well be right. The story works wonderfully well. Go away
to. Good luck with it.
Yes. It is not. I enjoy it greatly.
I'll be published, Catherine. I'll see to that. I know a jewel when I see one.
You always say that, Will, but I've had no luck so far.
This time you will. If old Leslie Stephen was still in charge at the Cornhill, your others would all have been accepted.
And if not, I will try my Nixie.
I'm sorry?
My version.
Your version?
Catherine has just said that if she is unlucky with her lunatic, I may try with my spirit. Didn't you, my dear?
Well, that is what you'd like, I think.
Oh, well, anyway, Will, we must away, my Nixie and I.
What? The night is young.
No, Will, I'm sorry. I have a chapter to finish.
Have another, man. It'll put a bit of color in your cheeks. You're like a ghost.
No, we must.
Really?
Really.
Yippee! Yippee! My dear parents, I have a great piece of news. There has been offered for Treasure Island. How much do you suppose? I believe it would be an excellent jest to keep the answer till my next letter. For 10 cents, I would do so. Shall I? Shall I? No? Well, £100, all alive, oh, 100 jingling, tingling, golden, minted quid. Is not this wonderful? Oh, the weather continues vomitable, and Fanny is quite out of sorts and talking of California, but really, with such a cause of gladness, I have not the heart to be disappointed by anything. It has been for me a treasure island, verily.
Robert Louis Stevenson. Treasure Island, 1883.
More New Arabian Nights by Robert Louis Stevenson with Fanny Stevenson, 1883.
With Fanny Stevenson, my foot. With.
My dear Henley, I will now make a confession. It was the sight of your maimed strength and masterfulness that begot John Silver in Treasure Island. Of course, he's not in any other quality or feature the least like you.
Oh, no. Only one leg. Not a bit like me.
Only a mouthful of holes and a face like a ham, boiled or smoked. Not in the least like me. Ho, 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 ho. And a bottle of rum.
But the idea of the maimed man, ruling and dreaded by the Sound, was entirely taken from you. Meanwhile, I keep a little better, and I'm downstairs today for the first time.
Deacon Brodie, a play by Robert Louis Stevenson and W.E. Henley, subtitled The Double Life. It played at Bradford and Edinburgh and the Prince's Theatre, London. It failed. The play went brilliantly, but the critics scorned it to a man.
Robert Louis Stevenson, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, dedicated to Catherine de Medos. A great success.
You be Mr. Hyde, Louis, and I'll be Mr. Seek.
Robert Louis Stevenson, kidnapped.
Admiral Guinea, a play by Robert Louis Stevenson and W.E. Henley. It did not go brilliantly. The critics scorned it to a man. But I am contemplating a new play. I shall not give up. We must not give up.
Robert Louis Stevenson, The Black Arrow.
Bournemouth, my dear Henley. Plays, at any rate, I do not think I can possibly look at before July. So let that be a guide to you in your views. July or August or September or thereabout. I think you had better suspend the visit till we can take you and till I can speak. It seems a considerable waste of money, above all, as just now I could not even offer you meals with my woman in such a state of overwork. My mother and father have had to go to lodgings. Post RLS.
Oh, Cassius. Oh, Brutus. Thou hast described a hot friend cooling. Ever note, Lucilius, when love begins to sicken and decay, it useth an enforced ceremony.
Good luck with the book on Duma. Soon, my lad, we sail for America. Fanny has found us a home in Saranac Lake, New York State. A health resort. A famous doctor spot. I must move, my lad, but slower now.
Lewis, where are you?
On board. On board that ship, I was so happy I could not have believed it possible. I'd literally forgotten what happiness was, and the full mind, full of external and physical things, not of cares and labors and rot about a fella's behavior. My heart literally sang.
Louis! It's getting cold!
Coming!
Oh, time and change, they range and range from sunshine round to thunder. They glance and go as the great winds blow and the best of our dreams drive under. For time and change are strange, are strange. And now they have looked and seen us. Oh, we that were dear, we are all too near with the thick of the world between us.
And when I got to New York, what? The New York World offered me $10,000 a year to do critical weekly articles for them. The sum was so enormous that I tottered. McClure offered $8,000 for serial rights of my next book. However, Scribner at once offered me the same scale to give him a monthly piece in Scribner's magazine. Indeed, it is rather higher. This I could not decently refuse. Again, I profit. Your book on Duma, I long to read it. In the matter of dedication, however, are not cross-dedications a little awkward? While I am here in Saranac Lake in the cold Adirondacks, Fanny has gone to relatives in San Francisco.
Dear Catherine, I write in haste. You will not have seen. How could you? Scribner's Magazine for March 1888, published in New York. In it you will find a story by Robert Louis Stevenson entitled Beggars. In it, you will also find a story entitled The Nixie by Fanny Vandergrift Stevenson. Your friend, W.E.H. Merton Place, Chiswick, March 9th. Private and confidential. Dear boy, I read The Nixie with considerable amazement. It's Catherine's. Surely it's Catherine's. The situation, the environment, the principal figure of Voyant. There are even reminiscences of phrases and imagery, parallel incident. Cassasia? It is all better focused, no doubt, but I think it has lost as much, at least, as it has gained. And why there wasn't a double signature is what I've not been able to understand. Lewis, dear lad, I am damn tired. The spring is spring no more. Don't show this to anybody. And when you write, don't do more than note it in a general way, if at all. By the time you do write, you will have forgotten all about it, no doubt. I wish you were nearer. Why the devil do you go and bury yourself in that bloody country of dollars and spew? And you don't even get better. And you are 4,000 miles from your friends. However, I suppose you must be forgiven, for you have loved me much. Let us go on so, till the end. Enfin, we have lived, we have loved, we have suffered. And the end is the best of all. Forgive this babble and take care of yourself. And burn this letter. Your friend, W.E.H.
Saranac Lake, New York State. My dear Henley, I write with indescribable difficulty, and if not with perfect temper, you are to remember how very rarely a husband is expected to receive such accusations against his wife. I can only direct you to apply to Catherine and ask her to remind you of that part of the business which took place in your presence and which you seem to have forgotten. I am sorry I must ask you to take these steps. I might take them for myself had you not tied my hands by the strange step of marking your letter private and confidential. An accusation of this gravity, you must suffer me to say, should not have been made without leaving me free to communicate with Catherine. From the bottom of my soul, I believe what you wrote to have been merely reckless words written in forgetfulness and with no clear appreciation of their meaning. But it is hard to think that anyone, and least of all my friend, should be so careless of dealing such
a... It came, the news, like a fire in the night, that life and its best were done. And there was never so dazed a wretch in the heat of the living sun.
To have inflicted more distress than you have done would have been difficult. This is the sixth or seventh attempt I make to write to you, and I will now only add that I count upon you immediately applying to Catherine for the facts and await your answer with the most painful expectation. You will pardon me if I find no form of signature. I pray God such a blank will not be of long endurance.
My dear lad, your letter is heartbreaking, and I do not know how to reply to it, for it convicts me, I now see, of a piece of real unkindness, unworthy of myself, and of our old true friendship. I should, I know now, have said nothing, and I shall never cease from regretting that I gave you this useless, this unnecessary pain. It seemed right that you should know how it looked to myself, and that there might well be an end of it. I was elbows deep in the business from the first, and I had, I thought, a right to make remarks. It is your mistake, dear lad, to imagine that I have ever been other than your true friend and servant.
Note his original position, carefully saved throughout. And yet, one, I gave him my word as to certain matters of fact. Two, and yet the letter can never be shown to my wife. Three, and yet even if he still thinks as he did, I think a kind spirit would have lied. It would have been so easy for Henley to make his letter presentable.
I am afraid to speak or breathe. There is devilry in the air.
Dear Catherine, there is always a door open. It is never too late to say, I have sinned. If not for others, at least for oneself. God knows my heart is heavy enough with my own offences to make me sicken at the thought of seeming harsh, but I counsel you, if you wish peace of mind, to do the right thing and to do it now. Your old friend and cousin, Robert Louis Stevenson.
If I have failed to understand anything said to me or put a wrong construction on things, I am more grieved than ever. But I cannot say it has been intentional.
A theft of money and of reputation? Suppose that I am insane and dreamt all that I seem to remember, and that my wife has shamefully stolen a story from my cousin. Was that the class of matter that a friend would write to me? It indicates a festering spirit. I told Fanny by letter. My dearest Gidley.
236 Taylor Street, San Francisco, California. The injury can never be condoned, nor do I ever wish to see England again. Indeed, if I can help it, I never shall. Are all English people like that? Are they, Louis?
My dearest Gidley, I have not written to you for some days. All my energies have gone into writing and destroying letters to Henley. But I have now decided, after two sleepless nights, to do nothing. And if, as I believe they will, things take the worst course, simply to let silence be the rest. I see no other way out of it. I envy you flimsy people who rage up so easily with hate. The days go, and this is the more dreadful to me. Excuse my little bitterness with flimsy. I wash my hands of these hobgoblin figures, once my friends. It's strange when you think what a couple of heartless, drunken dogs we were.
Under her foot she cast it. She trampled it where it fell. She broke it all to pieces, and each was a clot of hell.
I have parted company with half of a man and nearly half of myself. The old intimacy is impossible on the old terms.
Louis! Louis! I cannot get on without you!
Marriage puts old friends to the door.
236 Taylor Street, San Francisco, California. It is very hard to keep on living. If it so happens that I must go back to perfidious Albion, I shall learn to be false. For Louis's sake, I shall pretend to be that friend still, while he lives. I never go to bed now, but I am sorely tempted by the morphia and the arsenic. I try to forgive Henley, but in my heart I can never forgive him who has borne false witness against me. While he eats bread from my hand, and oh, he will do that, I shall smile and wish it were poison that might wither his body, as he has my heart.
And now, in the strictest confidence, to defend him. This business of the story was silly. Catherine, even while she consented, expressed unwillingness. I told my wife so, and I asked her to go no further. But Fanny had taken a fancy to the idea, and when Catherine had tried her version and failed, nothing would serve Fanny but to set on the unwilling consent and try hers. Hers succeeded.
Friends. Old friends. One sees how it ends. A woman looks, or a man lies, and the pleasant brooks and the quiet skies, ruined with brawling and caterwauling, enchant no more as they did before. And so it ends, with friends.
A Fable by Robert Louis Stevenson. A man quarrelled with his friend. "I have been much deceived in you," said the man, and the friend made a face at him and went away. A little after, they both died, and came together before the great white justice of the peace. It began to look black for the friend, but the man for a while had a clear character and was getting in good spirits. I find here some records of a quarrel, said the justice, looking in his notes. Which of you was in the wrong? He was, spoke the man. He spoke ill of me behind my back. Did he so, said the justice. And pray, how did he speak of your neighbours? Oh, he always had a nasty tongue, said the man. And you chose him for your friend, cried the justice. My good fellow, we have no use here for fools. So the man was cast into the pit, and the friend laughed out aloud in the dark, and remained to be tried on other charges.
For me, there were two Stevensons, the one who went to America and the one who never came back. The first I knew and loved. The other I lost touch with, and though I admired him, did not greatly esteem. My relation to him was that of a man with a grievance. There was the Stevenson who came to me in the old Edinburgh infirmary, where I opened his eyes and he opened mine. And there was this Louis, this faultless or nearly faultless monster, this seraph in chocolate. I refuse to recognize the Barley effigy of a real man now bandied about in biographies. That is not the Lewis I knew and loved, the old, riotous, intrepid, scornful, unmarried, irresponsible Lewis, the comrade, the friend, the charmer. Oh, in me, in many of us, Lewis, you excited passionate admiration and affection. Little wonder some men were jealous of others' place in your liking.
In Silver by Jonathan Smith, Robert Louis Stevenson was played by Bill Patterson, W.E. Henley by John Franklin Robbins, and Fanny by Maureen O'Brien. Catherine was Joanna Mackey, Leslie Stephen, Peter Copley, Joseph Lister, Bill Wallace. Lloyd, John Bolton, the sister, Eva Stewart, and the nurse, Marcia King. Silver was directed in Bristol by Sean McLaughlin.